Right. Today, we will do some physics. And in our favorite tome, this will start today with sections 14.4 and 14.5. And these deal with the take an accelerated charge. And it's going to send out photons created out of the ether, which doesn't exist. But the photons do exist. And we're going to tackle this in two different ways. The first way is to start with a qualitative discussion that kind of gives the big picture. And then we'll get into the math and do everything right. So I'm thinking mostly of synchrotron light sources here. So I'm going to consider circular motion. And so we'll have a perpendicular component of acceleration perpendicular to the velocity, which we could write as omega squared times the radius of the circle. So we have our circle, radius rho. This is, velocity is going this way. And so we expect this searchlight of radiation sweeping past us at every point. But I'll be especially interested in having some detector here. And as it sweeps by, we know there's an angular spread, and that will carry a frequency, can be decomposed into frequency distribution. So the perpendicular acceleration we can write as omega squared rho, which is also omega times the ordinary linear velocity at that point. And we're in the mostly interested in the highly relativistic limit, which is then pretty close to the speed of light. Okay, so this angular spread, you recall we had derived last time, it's of the order of 1 over gamma, this searchlight sweeping past us. And so in the time, I'll call it delta t of our radiation pulse, which is equal to delta theta over the angular frequency, the number of radians per second. This should, I could rewrite that as rho over gamma times the velocity. And in this time delta t, the particle moves a distance delta d, which is rho times that delta theta, which we're saying is approximately rho over gamma. And don't forget, gamma might be 10 in the vicinity, 10 to 100,000. Okay, so I want to now blow up this tiny stretch of the particle motion. Look at that in a little more detail. So let me make a diagram in this tiny section that is producing radiation that will be seen by this fixed detector. We can draw this as a isosceles triangle, and this will be delta D over 2, delta D over 2, each of these stretches here. I'll have these distances, and if we say that the time of emission is centered on a time capital T naught, then the time basically of this part of the pulse will be T naught plus delta T of the radiation over 2, and the time from this part of the pulse will be T naught minus delta TR over 2, and the center time is T naught, and what we're interested in is, of course, then there will be some distance capital R of T naught, which will be the distance from the source to the detector. Okay, so to an observer at the detector, the radiation begins at T1, which is T naught minus delta TR over 2, plus the distance R plus D over 2 over the speed of light. All right, the photons take some time to get to the detector. And this first part would be coming from here. And then the ends at T2, which will be T naught plus delta TR over 2 plus R minus D over 2, goes a little shorter distance. And delta T, which is T2 minus T1, will be delta T from the radiation duration alone, but then minus D over speed of light, which is rho over gamma U, minus rho over gamma C. And now we can do some binomials to simplify some of these. So for instance, use gamma 1 minus beta squared to the minus 1/2, or rewrite beta as 1 minus gamma to the minus 2 to the 1/2, which says beta, if we do a binomial, will be approximately 1 minus 1 over 2 gamma squared. Okay, so plugging all that in gives a duration of the pulse at the detector, which is rho for gamma C, 1 over beta, minus 1, which is approximately rho over 2 C gamma cubed. And it's always fun to see these factors of gamma to powers raised. I like that. Okay, now we know we can do a little Fourier analysis. To get the rough idea of what's going on. So, Mr. Fourier tells us that the frequency distribution then, based on that time duration, ought to look like that, ought to obey this identity. We also call that nowadays the uncertainty principle for the photon energy and the time duration. That suggests that there will be an approximate highest frequency, which is probably of order delta omega, which ought to be 1 over 2 delta t. So that's the estimate of the highest usable, again, it's rough, it's highest usable photons. If you want to use those photons, like at the APS synchrotron to do an experiment, so let's work out the numbers for that. This omega cutoff, we can now plug in our delta t over there. C gamma cubed over rho, which is a perpendicular gamma cubed over the speed of light. And let's see the numbers for the advanced photon source. Where rho is 39 meters and gamma is about 14,000. Then omega cutoff works out to be about 3 × 10⁸ meters per second over 39 meters and 1.4 × 10⁴ cubed, which is 2.1 × 10⁻¹ radians per second. And if you want, we can convert that to a photon energy by multiplying by h bar. And this gives 14 keV photons. Of course, this is without considering the insertion devices, which wiggle the electron, the positron, I should say, give it a little extra, even a lot of extra acceleration during those insertion devices. But you can look up what on the APS website. What they say is where peak intensity what's the frequency of the maximum intensity of the photons? And they say that is h bar omega at the peak is about 20 keV. So it's in the right ballpark for our estimate. In fact, usable intensity is more like up to around 100 keV. I know of experiments done up at 100 keV, but of course you're getting a lot fewer photons when you get up into the hundreds of keV. Okay, so that's qualitatively, I think, a simple way to understand roughly what's going on. But is that good enough for us? Do we want to see the math in full detail? Integrals, integration by parts? No. Damn, killjoy. I was going with that so happy. And now there will be no Green's functions. So that's more or less the whole topic, section 14.4, and now the quantitative treatment in all its beauty is section 14.5. Okay, quantitative treatment. Well, we know there is a quantity dP of t d omega, the angular distribution as a function of time of the power that would be detected, power of radiation detected. This will be the magnitude of a vector I'll call A of t, where A of t, we'll look at it in the radiation zone, is C over 4 pi times the magnitude of this distance to the detector R times the electric field, right, which is falling off like 1 over R. So by multiplying it by R, we get rid of the R dependence at long range. And this should be calculated at the retarded time. And I want to write this in the observer's frame. Remember, some of our discussion, we would try to find the power radiated from the point of view of the particle. But now we are more interested in the photons that are delivered at the detector, which actually won't be a detector. It will be like a vacuum where you've got molecules in it that are going to feel these photons. And then there will be detectors catching the electrons. Maybe other photons might come out afterwards after they've excited or ionized molecules. So what I'm calling the detector is really the experimental apparatus that houses all of those target quantities. Okay. So what we want, of course, are the frequencies that are going to be at the detector. Okay, so we can write the total energy then per unit time and per unit solid angle. As the integral over all times of this one burst as the positron comes flying by of this A of t squared dt. This would be the total energy from this pulse, a single pulse per unit solid angle. And now we're interested in frequency, not only angle, but we're interested in frequency. So we have to do Fourier analysis now in detail. Okay, so I'm going to write in the usual way the frequency components of A, call them A of omega, would just be the Fourier transform of A of t. We'll also want A of t, so we can, in terms of A of omega, so we'll want the inverse formula too. A of t is 2 pi to the minus a half integral A of omega e to the minus I omega t d omega, which we will now insert in that formula over there for dw d omega. We have 1 over 2 pi integral dt integral d omega that's squared, so we'll have to have an integral d omega prime for a second dummy integration frequency. Dummy. You dummy. A conjugate of omega prime dot A of omega e to the I omega prime minus omega t. And of course, the t integral we will do, including this bit and this bit. And that will give delta of omega prime minus omega and allows us to write dw d omega d capital omega as a distribution in frequency of this A of omega squared d omega. And so clearly this A of omega squared is going to tell us the how many photons are coming out at each frequency range. The conversion of this formula to this one in terms of the Fourier integral, Fourier transform, is what is called in Fourier analysis Parseval's theorem. That it's just this trivial relation between the A of t squared and the A of omega squared. And let time to have new chalk. Some other things. We know A of t is real. That tells us something that allows us to simplify that means A of minus omega must equal the conjugate of A of omega. I think we proved that back in chapter 6 or 7 when we were started doing monochromatic fields. And so we can do this as an integral over positive frequencies only as dw d omega is the integral just over positive frequencies now. and what I'll call D squared intensity that depends now on frequency and angle, n hat, d little omega, d capital omega. Where this quantity is equal to our A of omega squared plus A of minus omega squared, which is, of course, just twice A of omega squared. Okay, so now let's do the real thing and plug in our actual A of omega, which is a beautifully simple expression. You may remember we encountered some lectures ago. For one charge, we have its charge. There's an 8 pi squared C square root and an integral e to the I omega t. And now the bare formula of the radiation. Electric field comes in here. We have n hat cross n hat minus beta. Crossed into the acceleration vector, beta dot, all over 1 minus beta dot n hat cubed, all calculated at the retarded time and integrated over time. There's Fourier transform of our electric field amplitude in the radiation zone. We are going to do that integral whether you want to or not. I think you want to. Okay, what is the retarded time relation to our t we've been talking about? T equal the retarded time plus, there's this distance comes into the calculation of the retarded time between the emission point and the observation point, divided by the speed of light. And I want to change variables to this TR. In my integral, using this differential dt by dtr, which will be 1 minus beta dot n hat. And so that gives us a slightly different looking formula for this Fourier distribution in frequency. We've got our q squared, we've got our 8 pi squared c, we've got our tr integral minus infinity to infinity e to the I omega tr plus r of tr over c, and we'll have n hat cross n hat minus beta cross beta dot over now 1 minus beta dot n hat squared, because we included this factor, n hat squared, and then dtr. Next, we can make the long distance approximation at large r. We made this expansion back in chapter 9, right? r at tr is approximately the distance from one point, one little differential point doing the emission. Let's see. To this observation point. I'm sorry, yeah, I've confused myself. This is from like some little coordinate system in the center of the emitting region. That's the distance x from a fixed coordinate system, the vector x, to the observation point. But now we're going to be integrating over each little source, differential source in there at a vector r of tr. And then for that differential element, there is the vector r of tr from that particular element. And yeah, so this distance formula that we used when we were doing, I think we were doing scattering maybe, or maybe radiation in chapter 9, is x minus n hat dot r of tr. We need that level of approximation. Okay, right. And now Jackson has this propensity when he's struggling with the derivation, he just tosses out an identity. I'm going to follow in his venerable footsteps here and tell you an identity. Without proving it. He says this remarkable identity that this quantity we care about, n hat crossed into n hat minus beta crossed into beta dot over 1 minus beta dot n hat squared, this can be written as a perfect derivative of n hat cross beta over 1 minus beta dot n hat. Who would have guessed that? But you can check it on your own if you want to convince yourself that that identity is right. And seeing this derivative of something here makes us want to invoke the first rule of theoretical physics. You all remember that. When in doubt, integrate by parts. Exactly. Oh, yeah, you approximated everything by a harmonic oscillator. Yeah, that's a good one. I might invoke that one next lecture. Okay, let's do the integral by parts. We we have this beautiful quantity, the distribution, the quantitative distribution in angle and in frequency is q squared omega squared over 4 pi squared c, absolute value of this integral. I'm just trying to remember, where did the 1 minus beta dot n hat go? Yeah, I think that's right. That went away in the algebra. Okay, now I want to make one generalization to a charge distribution. So let's consider many charges, right? That means we're going to change q beta times this e to the minus the second term there, minus I omega over c n hat dotted into r of tr. We're going to make that a sum over all the charges, qj now. For the jth charge, it has its jth velocity vector, and this exponential factor in dot rj now for its position of tr, which will in turn can be recast as a current density integral 1 over c integral d cubed x prime now of current density at x prime and time tr. And e to the minus I omega over c n hat dot x prime. That's how we go from one charge to a current density collection of many charges. So we are almost done getting the general final formula, which we'll later in a few minutes apply. But everything comes down to this formula. It's the key result of this chapter, this section, d squared I, d omega, d capital omega, omega squared over 4 pi squared speed of light, integral, I'll call dt prime now, and a volume integral over the current density, n hat cross j of x prime, t prime, and then e to the I omega times t prime minus n hat dot x prime over c, integral squared. It's what you've been waiting for. Okay, so that brings us, after the derivation, to an application, which is section 14.6. Let's look in detail at the radiation spectrum. For highly relativistic limit and a particle in instantaneously circular motion. That allows me to specify the geometry in more detail here. Okay, so where am I going to put the diagram? I guess I could put it over here. Let's say we have an arc of the particle's trajectory. We're going to approximate it during this short time that we're going to feel a burst of radiation as an arc of a circle of some radius, rho. At this instant, particles moving along here, charge Q, and I'm going to make an axis, x-axis tangential to the circle. This will be the x-axis of my coordinate system. I'm going to make this rho my y-axis of my three-dimensional coordinate system, and z will be, of course, x hat cross y hat. And I'm going to keep my detector in the xz plane, so somewhere out here at a direction n hat will be my detector or my sample I'm going to irradiate at APS, which actually we know will be closer to x than I've drawn it, and we'll make an angle theta relative to x. We're going to need some more vectors. Okay, I wanted to keep track of the polarization of these photons. So there will be a component, let's say, in the plane containing the circular arc, which I'll call epsilon parallel polarization vector. And then there will be a component, basically, I guess at right angles, which I guess would be like along z, be the perpendicular component. Okay, I think that's all I need. You thought we were only going to get angle and frequency distribution, but we're going to get polarization also. So we have to make some assumptions as we try to reduce this to a little more manageable math. Okay, first assumption is that only a short part of the trajectory contributes. Okay. that is used, that short part, that little arc, used to define this XY plane. And again, x-axis is tangent to the arc and pointing in the direction the particle is moving. And it's tangent to it at the point y equals 0 and what we'll call time 0. The second assumption is that the path of the particle has an instantaneous radius of curvature that I'll call rho at time 0. And then as I drew over there, the detector is in xz plane at the following vector, n hat, as I've written, that choice of theta will be x hat cosine theta plus z hat sine theta. So it's not the usual spherical polar coordinates, which would have these thetas reversed. Okay, so my theta is pi over 2 minus the usual theta. Or pi, no. Yeah, pi over 2 minus the usual theta. And then finally, we have two polarization unit vectors. Epsilon parallel, which is in the y-hat direction, lies in the orbit plane. And epsilon perpendicular is, sorry, epsilon, yeah, of course it's n-hat cross epsilon parallel. Yeah, so that's why it's not actually aligned with z hat. I think I misspoke earlier. Just perpendicular to the orbit plane. Yeah, because you have photons, and of course you have a transverse wave, so your two vectors of polarization need to be orthogonal to n hat. So yeah, the epsilon parallel, since n hat is in the xz plane, that's automatically orthogonal to n hat. But epsilon perpendicular, I can't just pick one of these axes. I've got to take the cross product of epsilon parallel with n hat. Good question. Okay. Before I erase the beautiful formula, let me do some stuff in this blank space. So let's write down our circular approximation to this short section of the trajectory. R of t. Then we're approximated as rho x hat sine of omega t, which is ut over rho, plus rho y hat times 1 minus cosine ut over rho. And the velocity then, we can differentiate u x hat cosine of ut over rho plus u y hat sine u t over rho. And guess come back over here. This n hat cross beta, I'll go back to the form of this integral where it was for a single particle before I went to this general formula with j. You could also insert a Dirac delta function for j corresponding to a single particle moving at velocity u if you want, but I'll just come back to this form with n hat cross beta. And, well, you don't really want to see me take that cross product, I don't think. Let me just write the result. Epsilon perpendicular hat. There's a couple of lines of algebra in the notes. If you want to go through that cross, double cross product, it works out to be epsilon perpendicular beta cosine of ut over rho minus epsilon parallel sine ut over rho. And don't forget, epsilon parallel is the same as y hat here. And we'll need to simplify the argument of the exponential in the Fourier integral there. Omega times t minus n hat dot r of t over c is omega t minus omega rho over c sine of u t over rho cosine theta. In the dot product, right, just the component of r in the xz plane survives. And this we can approximate invoking our Taylor expansion. Looks like omega t minus omega rho over c 1 minus a half theta squared. We remember theta is order 1 over gamma is tiny. And the frequency part, we can expand the sine function to third order. Ut over rho minus 1/6 u cubed t cubed over rho cubed. It's going to make these integrals more tractable, which is omega times 1 minus u over c t plus theta squared over 2 u over c omega t, and then plus t cubed over 6 omega over c u cubed over rho cubed. Okay, but u over c is 1 minus gamma to the minus 2 to the 1 half, you'll all remember, which is binomial 1 minus a half gamma to the minus 2. So that is going to simplify everything. Fairly compact result, omega over 2 gamma to the minus 2 plus theta squared t plus c squared over 3 rho squared t cubed. And terms of order gamma to the minus 2 smaller than that these terms. So we have that, and we have to leading order the n hat cross beta can write in terms of the polarization vectors epsilon perpendicular times theta minus epsilon parallel times ct over rho. I want you to remember something I told you the first day of ENM1, what my goal was for you guys. My goal was that you make the transition from when you see a Bessel function, saying, oh my God, damn it, this problem involves Bessel functions. The transition to, oh my goodness, this problem is so simple, we can write the answer in terms of Bessel functions. This was my goal. And today it will be realized because I'm about to derive a Bessel function. And you will be happy. Okay, let's go to our integral now. Q squared omega squared of 4 pi squared speed of light. These lovely factors, and now I'll write the answer is epsilon perpendicular times the perpendicular component of this vector A we defined, minus epsilon parallel times the parallel component of omega. And these each is separately an integral. So a perpendicular of omega works out to have a theta factors out of the integral times integral dt from minus infinity to infinity, e to the I omega over 2, gamma to the minus 2 plus theta squared t plus c squared t cubed over 3 rho squared. And a parallel of omega then is c over rho out front, which is omega, minus infinity to infinity dt. And we have t e to the I omega over 2 gamma to minus 2 plus theta squared t plus c squared t cubed over 3 rho squared. And I need to make a variable change. I'll define c as omega rho over 3 times the speed of light, gamma to the minus 2 plus theta squared to the 3 halves. And then we get our final answers. You can type this into Mathematica or look it up in Gradstein and Rizik if you like. The result of those integrals. Gives the final results. A, the perpendicular polarization component is rho over C root 3. There's still this theta, so approximately 1 over gamma minus 2 plus theta squared to the 1/2. And here we have a Bessel function, k 1/3 of C. Any of you remember what k looks like? The k Bessel function? Exponentially decaying one. So yeah, it would be irregular at the origin at C equals zero, but I guess C presumably will never be exactly zero here where we apply it. So yeah, it's just kind of looks like that. And a parallel of omega is rho over C root 3, again minus 2 plus theta squared. I don't think it's to the 1/2. At least it's not in my notes, but you might double check. If you apply this in the textbook to k 2/3 now of C. By the way, Bessel functions with a 1/3 or 2/3 argument order, I should call it, not argument. These are famous, they arise in many other contexts, and they are the class of functions called Airy functions, which are a particularly simple subset out of the whole set of Bessel functions. That's all I wanted to say about frequency distribution. Is that enough? That's what it looks like in angle and in frequency. And it depends on the angle and the frequency in this complicated way. So it'll be different at different angles. But it is falling off as you move to larger theta, right? Because it's exponentially decaying. I don't remember. I think that the origin, the Bessel function, goes like C to this power. So at smaller angles, I believe that's the way this function behaves. Well, if you wanted like the without polarization sensitivity, you would just add the a perpendicular squared and the a parallel squared. So just add them in coherently. If you do, you're good? Okay. So One of the last topics I'm going to cover this semester is this interesting subject of radiation reaction. We'll just get a start on it today to lay out some of the issues. They are subtle and complicated, and to be honest, they're not completely a solved problem. Although I guess there is a working solution to the fundamental difficulties that seems to be used, like if you design the LCLS or you had to design the APS, there are equations that seem to work for those regimes. But essentially everything fails at small distances or very short times. Okay, this is section 16.2 about radiation reaction force. Okay, so we're going to jiggle a charge. We're going to apply an external force, external field, that makes a force I'll call F external. When we do that, we know the charge will accelerate. And the accelerating charge radiates photons. And if photons come out of the charge, that means it had to lose energy by energy conservation. Some of its energy, kinetic energy, went into photons. So one way to think about that is to think that the radiation of the charge has emitted must act back on the charge and give a recoil force. And we'll call that F radiation. That's what we're trying to understand. And to keep the argument simple, let's look in the non-relativistic limit at some of the basic considerations. So mu dot will equal this externally applied force initially, when we don't consider this extra radiation reaction. Then the power radiated, the total power radiated, is the Larmor formula, right? P of t is 2/3 q squared over c cubed u dot squared. And right, if you have these photons coming out, recall they mostly go kind of sideways in the limit of non-relativistic limit, as opposed to the highly relativistic limit where they're coming out in the direction of the acceleration. But we expect, like if your velocity is parallel to that, we expect there to be a force opposing it due to this radiation reaction concept that will reduce u from what it would be if we had ignored that radiation reaction. So at the very least, this force should have a force opposing the velocity. I guess I'm calling it U, which will reduce U, the magnitude of U. This is what we are expecting. Now, moreover, we have an energy conservation argument that should tell us something about the strength of that force. Namely, energy conservation would suggest that the energy per unit time associated with that, which is force dotted into velocity, that's the power, this should coincide with that power, which is minus 2/3 q squared over c cubed u dot squared. So that's the kind of most naive picture, which is not actually true in general. But there are some special cases where it's true. Let me explain why it's not necessarily true. And basically, the main reason is that there exist electromagnetic fields, as we know, that are associated just with the charge in uniform motion, right? Charge in uniform motion has its fields E and B that we derived back in chapter 6, I think, and again maybe later in this semester. So these fields associated with Q at uniform velocity, these also have energy. So if the velocity changes, those field energies also come into the energy conservation balance. It's not only in the radiated fields. Okay. So a more correct statement would say that the energy lost by Q during a time interval T1 to T2 should equal the energy, I'm almost ready to stop for the day, energy in the radiation, in its radiation, plus the change in energy due to the change in the uniform velocity fields. Uniform velocity fields. So one way we'll try to circumvent that issue next time is by thinking of a periodic motion, like a synchrotron. The particle is periodic. And so if we, you know, consider a periodic motion, we can get rid of this second term, and we can use our energy conservation argument to derive the formula for this radiation force, which will turn out to be wrong. And that'll be fun. Okay, enough for today. Try to remember, by the way, if some of you haven't done it yet, the evaluation for the course. So I'd appreciate it.